The Jaffe's are here. Now I can begin. All right. It's today is Monday, March 23rd, 2015. It's our final shiur before the break for Pesach. And we have a lovely crowd in front of us. And even a larger and a fabulous crowd around the world. We're in the middle, it's our third year, in the middle of the history of Torah in the United States. I don't want to repeat myself, but there are new faces here. So just to say, the reason I got involved on this topic, I hear it. Well, let me just check that. If I signal you loud, sort, that's the
okay.
That one there. The reason I got involved in this topic is Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein stopped teaching. And at the same time, my mother died. I recognized my age. Until then, I was always a kid. When you have a mother and every morning you visit her and she says, Arnie, how are you? You're a kid. And all the years that the Kollel exists from 1978 on, I never repeated a shiur. I also never taught anything I knew. But with Reb Aaron stopping to teach and my mother, Zichrona Levracha, I said, I better get out of my system what I know. And there are not many people alive anymore who know all this, the history of Torah in the United States. It's my doctorate and all the research I did and all that I've lived and experienced. And we started 2.5 years ago, almost 3 years ago, and Baruch Hashem, we still have a number of years to go. And right now, after spending so many months on the yeshiva in America, on the Litvische Welt and Yeshiva University, and bringing you to 1960, I feel if we're talking about the United States, we have to devote a number of months to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And I don't know if this is the fourth or fifth or sixth lecture already, but we have many more to go on the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, before I begin, I just want to mention we got a lot of correspondence. And coming back to my lectures on why you, when talking about the Mashgiach, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe HaKohen lessons at Tzal, I mentioned that he lost all his family, remember, except one son and one daughter. He remarried in America, and my dear Talmud, Josh Schneider, sends me an email that he had a brother. When I said he lost all family members, I meant the immediate family. He had a brother who lived near the yeshiva, Rabbi Eliyahu Lessen, who was the Mashgiach at Shmulka Bernstein's. So those of you who recall Shmulka Bernstein's, that's his brother. One second, Josh also sent me more material. Yeah, and he describes his father, who was a contemporary of mine in the yeshiva, Marvin Schneider, and he says, my father is not the typical Litvak. My father is the typical Litvak, not emotional. But one time we were discussing Rabbi Lessen, and he told me he remembered the Zemer of Shabbos, Shah Shalom, that Rabbi Lessen used to sing. I could see tears welling up in my father's eyes, and he began to sing the Zemer as if he had heard it only yesterday. Also, I recall reading that among the activities Rabbi Lessen was involved with in Boston, through those activities he became acquainted with the Rav, and he was the Mashgiach of the Rav's Kollel Hechel Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi in Boston. So I just want to mention that, yes, the Rav knew Rabbi Lessen from Boston. He was Rav in a neighboring community. He came to America in 1939, Rabbi Lessen, and the East Europeans pulled him into the Boston area. That's how his son-in-law, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, winds up in the Massachusetts area. His relationship to the Rav was very warm. To say he was Mashgiach in the Kollel probably is an overstatement, because the Kollel, I write about it in Revel, the Kollel began at approximately 39. It only lasted through 41. What happened was the Rav was appointed to the YU faculty and he had to stop commuting. He gave the Kollel over to his cousin, to Rabbi Chil Michal Feinstein, that's Rabbi Moshe's nephew, and it didn't thrive under Rabbi Chil Michal. He was not the Rav. So Rabbi Moshe then brought him to New York, and he taught at MTJ. And then from Israel, they said to him, are you marrying the Brisker Rav's daughter, or yes or no? And if you're marrying her, you have to come to Israel, because the Brisker Rav's daughter was not willing to leave Israel. And he came and married her. And that was Rabbi Chaim Lechel Feinstein, the Brisker Rav's eldest son-in-law, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. Rabbi Lessin evidently gave some shmuisen, sichot, in the Kollel in Boston, the Heichel Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi. I don't ever recall seeing he was officially the Mashgiach, but there's no question in my mind that the Rav asked him to give shmuisen, and the Rav had great derechets for him, as we spoke about. Very fascinating. Regarding the Boston area, and where Rabbi Lessin was rabbi, and afterwards Rabbi Miller in Chelsea, one of the main balabatim and the head of the Mizrahi was an individual named Harry Kraft. And his son, Robert Kraft, is the owner of the New England Patriarch. Okay? Now, in relation to what I've been quoting on the Lubavitcher Rebbe from the Deutsch book, my dear Talmud, Lieutenant Colonel, I got to give him all his titles, Rabbi Mark Wiener, wrote to me, wow, this Rabbi Deutsch is the individual who built the museum in Borough Park on all aspects of Torah and animals. He's a fabulous individual. And and he's a fabulous individual, and he worked for the big firm in New York, JNR, I believe it's called, and he was the head of their whole financial department. Rabbi Deutsch is a financial genius, is a man that wears many hats. He runs a consulting firm. He supports himself. He's the Ligashna Rebbe. He runs the museum. He has 30 people working for him. His wife, who I met and was very impressed with, the Bamakar Israeli. I have to tell you, I'm an Israeli. I wish they were all here. I wish the museum were here. But one day it has to come here. Nothing less than the Golah, as we see. His wife knows how to work a forklift. She's very capable. He says, how many Rebbetzins can do that? Now, my dear Talmud Steve Gross, I have to say, when I mentioned about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, we got involved on people who sleep very little and how much they accomplish. And I told you, I know Rabbi, he goes by the name today, Shlomo Riskin, but I follow the Ramban and Pashit Bo. I also want to call him Rabbi Steve Riskin. His secret is he sleeps 3 hours a night. And I told you, I once came to New York with him on the same plane. I got off the plane half dead, and he got off the plane with a suit, with a tie, ready to take $1 million from the next balabasi with me. So that's it now. Then I told you about the Vilna Gaon. I remember the Vilna Gaon, who used to sleep a half hour every six. And that's an interesting question. Do you know that Steve Gross sent me an article, polyphasic sleep or polyphasic sleep, from the Wikipedia? Do you know that experiments have been done on this with pilots in the Italian Air Force, the American Air Force? Pilots who have to be alert and awake basically 24/7. And believe it or not, the system they use is a half hour every 6 hours, exactly what the Vilna Gaon did. So you see, it's not something that the children of the Vilna Gaon write about and you read it as an Agadah. No, it's absolutely true. Now, then I want to go one step further. Harry Ullman, I believe he's from Manchester, again, when you got a letter, you know where it was from. When you get an email, you're not sure. But it is, I believe it's Manchester, the United Kingdom. So he caught me pulling one over you, and I plead guilty, and I'll explain to you. When I spoke about the Rebbe getting smicha in Germany, so I spoke about Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. So I mentioned that Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg succeeded Professor Hoffman as rector of the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary. And I mentioned to you, and I explained how the German Orthodox Jew went from a German feeling to becoming more Litvish, a result of World War I. They wanted more, they wanted warmth, and they wanted someone like Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. And then we went on to the story of how the Lubavitcher Rebbe got smicha from Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. What I purposely left out, there was an interregnum of 3 years when Avraham Eliyahu Kaplan took over for Professor Hoffman, and lo aleinu, he died young, 1924, 33 years of age. I yet knew his father. His father worked for the Jewish Aid, not his father, his son, Reb Tzvi Kaplan, worked for the Jewish Agency when I came in Aliyah. And the reason I left it out, I lectured on this extensively 20 years ago in the Kollel, spent many weeks, but if I would get involved too early, in other words, when I say David Tzvi Hoffman, you know who I'm talking about. When I say the Sridiyesh, you know who I'm talking about. When I would talk about Avraham Eliyahu Kaplan, I would have to spend an hour explaining who he was and what happened. So I figured, for the sake of the lecture, I'll bypass it. And I have to compliment Harry Ullman, who caught me, and I plead guilty. But there's a reason why. So those of you who want to pick up what happened from 21 to 24, go to my lectures approximately 20 years ago. Now, he also tells me something else. Remember, there's a rumor in Chabad that the Rebbe got smicha from the Ragged Shafa. And I said, I don't know if that's true. It's true that the Rebbe corresponded with the Ragged Shafa, but to say he got smicha, I don't know if it's true. So he tells me that Mr. Monty Newman of Manchester, who learned in pre-war Nitra and Mir, and wrote a thesis on the Ragged Shafa, told the number of people in Manchester that he asked Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Now, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, who I yet had the schut to know, was a gon shebegoinim. I mean, the Encyclopedia Talmudica is his, and all the works that he published, and he was a Chabadnik. I still recall when Shazar was president, and Shazar's brother got out of, Rabbi Zevin's brother got out of Russia, early 70s. Now you can imagine, one brother was the Gadol Hadar, and a younger brother raised in communist Russia barely knew Tzuras and Aleph from a bet, Kent Garnish, never under. So they wanted to show him who his brother is, and Shazam made a Kabbalat Panim for Rabbi Zevin, and to welcome his brother at the president's house. And how does a little kid from the Bronx like myself get invited? Because my neighbor's Rabbi Yoshua Hutner, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, who was Rabbi Zevin's right hand. So Rabbi Hutner said, it's interesting, come. It was very, very fascinating. So I knew Rabbi Zevin, I knew his stepdaughter, I knew the family. Ugh, what an individual. So he asked Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin if the Rebbe had smicha from the Ragged Shava. And Rav Zevin replied, Ich mein as nicht. I believe not. So Baruch Hashem, I'm in good company when I say it has never yet been proven about the Rebbe having smicha from the Ragged Shava. Okay, now let me pick up where we left off last week. And I also want to thank all the people across the world who contacted YU and had such nice words to say about last week's lecture. You don't have to give me the credit. Give the credit to the sources, to the Rav, to the Rebbe. It was a very moving and a very important lecture last week. I hold last week's lecture. I went as far as to ask my grandchildren to listen to it because it's the heart of Yiddishkeit. Now, there's no question that the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Cheder and your early years influenced your whole life. Those of you familiar with Washington to Washington, you all know that one moment in 1944 changed my whole eternity, and it's the reason I'm sitting here, Kanayin Hara. Very simple. You come to class, and it was right before Normandy. And if you recall the story, I have that story, and Chaim Sabato has a similar story. I corresponded with him, and it's just amazing how many times this must have happened, these effects. And I come into class, and Mr. Markovich was in his 50s, and he says to the class, yeah, you kids are all talking about the war, what's going to go on, and where the Allies are going to land. You got to remember that period. Everyone knew my father had maps on the wall, and we were following and WOR and the news. And And he says, and you think I'm an old man. He says, I want you to know I fought in World War I. And then he tells us a story that changes my life. He fought in World War I. He and his friend, two Jewish boys, front line opposite the Germans, Russian kids. And they're shooting at the Germans. And his friend scores a direct hit. And the German soldier throws down his gun and with his last strength shouts, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, and dies. And he says, my friend went out of his mind and he committed suicide 2 days later in a Russian field hospital that a Jew had killed a Jew. So, you know, that little incident, I went to school how many years? 24 years, elementary, high school, college, postgraduate, and one day changes your whole eternity. So there's no question certain things that happened to the Rebbe, very fascinating in Cheder. And again, I'm quoting from Deutsch, page 64. And here he doesn't give a name. When I attended Cheder, I had a teacher. It may or may not have been Rabbi Vilenkin, who we spoke about last week, his main Rebbe in Cheder. When I attended Cheder, I had a teacher who was a very sincere person. He spent all his time studying only Torah. However, on days like Tisha B'Av, when it is forbidden to learn until, he says here, until the afternoon, I don't know what that means, until the afternoon, you don't sit on a bench. In the afternoon, you can sit down on a bench. Shalom Aleichem, you can't say all day. In the afternoon, all right, maybe, I don't know. I don't know if to take it literally or simply it was whoever wrote it up, mistook what the Rebbe was saying. But what you can learn in the afternoon, you can learn in the morning. What you can't learn in the morning, you can't learn in the afternoon. But Siken Zayin, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe in correspondence with the Rocket Shava, you know that the Rocket Shava learned on Tisha B'Av. He held it to be Pikuach Nefesh, you understand? So it could be in the afternoon is make you give him, but I don't think so. I think it's simply a mistake. It is forbidden to learn to. A teacher would talk to us about permissible subjects, such as the belief in God. Once the subject was the creation of the world, he mentioned the theory of evolution. I began to discuss with a fellow student regarding what their so-called proofs are. In other words, the Rebbe, who, as we've seen, had this natural interest in science, when they started talking evolution, he started to talk with another student discussing the proofs, the pros, the cons. In the midst of all, my teacher turned to me and said, quote, Mendel, why do you need to discuss such people? If they want to believe they came from apes, let them. Now you just think about what the Rebbe told him and the impact it leaves. Either way, one way is, you know, there's a limit how much you can argue. People want to believe, so sein gesund. You're not going to change merits, okay? You can argue from today to tomorrow. But merits is merits, they're here to stay, they have a point of view, the maskilim, the lishkat hachoshech that I've spoken about. On the other hand, you know, maybe you can't give up when a Jew can feel that the way he thinks, his thought process, he comes from an ape. It could be, besofa shel davar, he's going to say, wait a minute, I have human dignity, I have a soul. So you can interpret this either way, but the Rebbe spoke about this in a public talk, one of the sichot, one of the Fabrengens. He gives you the source, the Deutsch. So it shows you it left a big impact. What story does this remind you of? Remember, over the years I've told you I was an ear witness, a story that Art Scroll tells that for once Rakefet can say they're telling the truth, because I was sitting right there, believe it or not. I mean, it's a slut. I was sitting right there. What am I talking about? The plane with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Yeruchim Meshel, the head of the Jewish agent, the head of the J. What was he? The head of the Histadrut. And here they're on the plane, sitting right in front of me. I'm going to New York. It's 1980. It's right after the last Knesa Gedolah that you will ever see in my lifetime, in your lifetime, in Eli's son's lifetime. Thank my word for Eli. There will not be Knesa Gedolah again. Not to have a Knesa Gedolah, you have to have some peace between the factions. What's going on today in the literature world within, with the chazakah world without, bilti efshari, and I needn't elaborate, or we'll all start crying, and today is sad enough with the funerals, so let's not even talk about what's going on in Agudat Yisrael, seven little children being buried today. Vic, we met the first time a half minute walk from where the tragedy, took place. Are you aware of it?
Right.
The shul on Bedford Avenue, right there, right across the street, a half minute away. That's where we met the first time. So, where was I? So I'm on the plane, and Yaakov Kamenetsky gets on, and Parish, and Lawrence, everyone's accompanying him. And by the way, in the same plane was Rav Ruderman, but he slept. Rav Yaakov sits down, a bulk seat, a good seat they gave him, Baruch Hashem. And he's right next to Rabbi Yerucham Meshel. And standing over Rabbi Yaakov is a young man with a beard, with, you know, yeshivish dress, and litvish dress, I'll say. And they're Rabbi Yaakov, and they're talking. And finally, Rabbi Yerucham Meshel and Zayreta Akashmak in Yiddish, this is the native language of Rabbi Yaakov and of Yerucham Meshel. And Meshel says to Rabbi Yaakov, "Who is that young man?" And he says, "It's my grandson." And Yerucham Meshel says, "Your grandson?" And he talks to you and he stands. He says, "I have nothing in common with my grandson. We have nothing to talk about. We're in two different worlds." Rabbi says, "Well, there's a reason why." Now, I imagine Rabbi Yaakov said this with a sense of humor, but he made a very strong point. He says, "My grandchildren hover around me because I'm closer to Matan Torah. I'm closer to Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm two generations ahead of them, going backwards to the source, to the holiness, to the revelation. Matan Torah, Maimet HaSinai. You believe man comes from apes? Why should your grandchildren want to be near you if you're two generations closer to the apes, closer to the Darwin theory?" And that is a fabulous fart. Here you see it. Mendel, why do you have to discuss such people if they want to believe they come from apes? Let them. Very interesting. I want to say in parentheses, just once again to make an analogy to the Rav, what's fascinating is that all the problems that bothered us in the 50s, evolution, creation, how old the earth is, the Rav said publicly many times, none of these problems bother him. And he gave us an unbelievable example how to deal with it. Adam 1 and Adam 2. The lonely man of faith. And you see what he does in Adam 1, Adam 2? He bypasses all the problems of the biblical critics. And he says, Torah Hashem Tamima. We need both creations, because they're two different type of people. Torah has to relate to the human being in totality. The lonely man and the communal man. But the word, you know, the Rub's words, the majestic man. But, wow, that was the Rub. Never. Rav Kasha published so many articles. There's Torah Shlema came out in an English version, the Encyclopedia of Biblical Interpretations, I think it was called. And in volume one, you'll find tens and tens and tens of pages, a whole addendum dealing with the problems of evolution and the age of the earth and everything that concerned us at that time as kids growing up. And the Rav's attitude was, Torah Hashem Tamima, and everything can be taken into context. Adam 1, Adam 2 is a classic example. And by the way, that's the most popular of everything the Rav that's been published in the Rav's name. That probably is the most popular. That and Kol Dodi Dofek. I personally think the Hesped for Reb Chaim Heller is the ultimate apex. Reb Aaron Lichtenstein always spoke in terms of the Hesped for the Brisker Rav, but the world reacts. You see, the Hesped for Reb Chaim Heller, for the Brisker Rav, you had to know who they were, where the Rav was coming from. But Adam 1, Adam 2, every individual has ever opened up a chumash is entranced. So this is one part of a similarity between the Rav and the Rebbe and their whole outlook on science. But I love mental. If they want to believe they came from apes, let them. Now, then he tells something else about Cheda. And here, it's just amazing. The Rav tells a very similar story. In Cheda, my teacher once explained in jest about a people's attitude in a Din Torah. He said it was interesting to note that some people, how people react to a halachic decision. If you were to come in front of the rabbinical court and ask whether an animal is kosher or not, and the decision given by the rabbis was negative, meaning that the animal was treif, the owner of the animal would quickly throw the animal away. Not only would he not eat it, but he would make sure no one else would eat from it, even though it might cause him significant monetary loss. Yet if the same person had a financial dispute with a friend over a few pennies, and the halachic decision rendered favored the other person, the man's reaction would be to scream and shout in protest, even threatening to find another rabbi who will rule in his favor. My teacher explained the reasoning of this phenomenon in the following manner. The person who lost the case isn't screaming because he lost money. Rather, it bothers him that the other person has gained money. And gives you a source from the Rebbe talking about this in a public lecture of Fabrengen. There's a lot of insight here. See, human beings, a lot of insight. That I lost money, all right, I lost money. But that he should gain. New, what's the version we heard from the Rav so many times? I don't know, I wrote it up in the Rav, or if Rav Schechter wrote it up, and I know I spoke about it in class 20, 30 years ago in the Kollel. The Rav said that it happened either by Rav Chaim, or I think it happened by Rav Yosef Dov, by his great-grandfather. So there was a Din Torah, and the person lost money, and he walked out cursing, shouting, screaming. And I think he said, the way the Rav told the story, Reb Chaim asked his father, if I'm missing a generation, Reb Moshe asked Reb Chaim, why is it that same person, if you would declare the cow treif, would accept it magnanimously, would not argue, would not yell, would not shout? And because he lost money, he's hysterical. And Reb Chaim or the Beit Halevi answered, he's not hysterical about the loss of money. See, when you declare the animal treif, it's treif, what can you do? When you say he lost the case in a Choshen Mishpat, it means you're declaring him a fake or a phony. You're criticizing the very essence of his ethical being, of his moral being. That's why he's so upset. It's an interesting, interesting point. But it's amazing the similarities between the Rav and the Rebbe and what they were exposed to. Now, I just want to go one step further on the star of last week's Shayur on the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Melamed, Rav Shneur Zalman Vilenkin, and I thank the Chabadnikim who sent me in more material on him. And what I didn't realize, he was not Stam a Chassid. He grew up with the seventh Rebbe's father, with Reb Levi Yitzchak Schneerson. And they learned together as children. They went to Cheder together. And Reb Levi Yitzchak knew him as a London Muvhak. And when he came to Yekrathanalov, if I'm pronouncing it right, to be Rav, Reb Levi Yitzchak, he brought his childhood friend to be the Sheikhet. But there was one problem there. Already was a Sheikhet there. So he said, become a Melamed. And he started a Cheder with his three sons were Rabbi the Lenken's first students, and that's how the Rebbe knew him so well. Now, the Talmud sent me a picture, if you recall, the picture in Deutsch's book of the Matseva, Rabbi the Lenken's grave, did not come out clear. But here you have a very, very clear picture. And I'll read to you. Harav hachava yisharei lakim hayasis malatu kvodo harav dam shnil zalmen berav levi yitzchak v'lenken asak habei shanim mebelechet Hashem lamad v'limeid berabim v'yim talmidim v'zacha shekvod kedushato admur harav reb Menachem Mendel Shlita lamad etzlo. And then it goes on by Ashoka to Baldeik, etc. But that's what we said last week, that the Rebbe said they should write on his matseva that he was a malamet and taught so many youngsters. And when they wrote it on the matseva, they added the fact, spelled out, that he taught Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Okay, so that's filling in with last week, and we're ready to go further. So now we have this young Menachem Mendel growing up. He's not influenced at all by the currents, by the tides, not like his youngest brother, who also had tremendous range of knowledge and a tremendous mind. He's not influenced by socialism. He's not influenced by atheistic Zionism, I'll call it, or agnosticism Zionism. And yet he's been exposed to a whole entire world, and he can function in the big world. And he's photographic memory, Shas, Peskin, Kabbalistic literature, philosophy, the deal that Reb Menachem Mendel made with his father, 16 hours learning Torah subjects, and the other 8 hours, sleep, eat, drink, and general subjects. And in 1923, he visits the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Yitzchak Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, visits the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe for the first time. And a shidduch is made with the Lubavitcher Rebbe's middle daughter, Chaya Mashka. Now, a lot has been written about the shidduch, a lot has been written about the 5-year wait until they marry. And when you read Friedman's work, Friedman and Heilman, Heilman American, Friedman from Bar-Ilan University, you get the feeling of 5-year wait. Yes, it's not the average type of shidduch you will see in a Hasidic world. And again, I've told you more than once, they talk about afterwards the Rebbe in Berlin, the Rebbe in France, and anyone familiar with the Friedman of Heilman work, you get the feeling the Rebbe is running away. And I just want to go on record, to my humble opinion, having known, and you know my insight to Lubavitch and my periscope into the court and my contacts and my closeness with the Groner family, and having read to the best of my knowledge all the volumes that have been published on the Rebbe, studied them both in English and both in Hebrew, I want to just share some insight with you. The Rebbe was never running away from anything. The Rebbe was exactly like the Rebbe. There was intellectual curiosity. They went to Berlin. They went to France. They broadened. But chas v'chalila, to think for a moment, they were running away from anything. The Rebbe obviously felt that he would never become the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe. There was an older brother-in-law, Rav Shmaryu Gur Aryeh. We'll talk about him in much more depth. He was married to the eldest sister. I believe, what was her name? The eldest one, Chana. They're three sisters. I believe her name was Chana. He was married to Chana, and he lived, Mamish, they lived door-to-door with the Rebbe. They lived with the 6th Rebbe. They were part of, it was one family the sixth Rebbe, his wife, his eldest daughter, his son-in-law, Rav Shmuel Garaye, the Rebbe evidently was convinced 100% that he would become the seventh Rebbe, Rav Shmuel Garaye. And whatever, the Rebbe was interested, a person has to make a living. You should know that the Rav began school at the Free University of Warsaw, Warsaw Free University, whatever it was called. Look into my work on the Rav, you'll get the exact name. The Rav was studying law. Could you imagine the Rav? Rabban Soloveitchik had a law degree. He made a living in addition to giving a shiur in Chaim Berlin, which didn't pay that much, obviously. Rabbi Snow, that's Vic's uncle, was a Rebbe together with Rabban Soloveitchik. So Rabban supplemented his income by writing briefs for lawyers. He was a genius, Rabban, so he could put together all the sources, a lawyer who had to appear in court and had to influence the judge. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, evidently, when all was said and done, what attracted him the most was engineering, electrical engineering. He became an expert in how to build an electrical system on a ship. He worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. They were not running away from anything. But this was the world in which he found himself. Russia was too stifling. Here you're in Western Europe, you're in Berlin, you're in Paris, you're at the heart of civilization, and you'll be able to make a living. And this was the Lubavitcher Rebbe, as I understand it. Now, as far as the Shidduch goes, all these people that carry on 5 years, what they don't understand is what the communist system was. And Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, one of the great zchuyot I have is that the Mossad tapped me on the shoulder in May of 1980, scared the hell out of me, and I had the guts, so due to my wife, only due to my wife, to say, yes, I'm willing to go to teach Gemara in Moscow. I mean, it's like it's jumping off the moon. And we were briefed, and as much as they brief you when you go through it, I remember Tzvi Grona until the day he died. Tzvi, my dear friend Tzvi, was still shaken up at what he went through with the KGB at point of entry. All right, we went through hell, but to say the Baruch Hashem, I recovered. I have that ability to bounce back. But you know, you don't understand the communist system. The Rebbe's parents were in communist Russia. The Rebbe was already traveling. When I say the Rebbe, I mean the seventh Rebbe. They were dreaming they could make a shidduch, they could come together, it could be done properly. Who ever heard of getting married without your parents there? And you have to understand, the Rebbe was already a figure unto himself, the seventh Rebbe. He was in Berlin, he was traveling, he was there. 5 years went by very, very quickly. They were young yet when the shidduch was made. And you should know that the Rebbe got married approximately the very same age as the Rav got married. And they were conquering the world intellectually. They were busy a thousand ways over. But I can assure you, in my humble opinion, that had the Rebbe's parents been able to get out of Russia and meet with the sixth Rebbe, meet with their cousins, remember, they're interrelated, as we've said. And the seventh Rebbe was a direct descendant of the Tzemach Tzedek, of the third Rebbe. So he was a very distant cousin of Chaim Mushka. Had they been able to work out a normative relationship, they would have gotten married a lot earlier. But these were the times, this was the reality, this was communism. We don't know what the Chabadnikim, the price they paid, the executions, the exile. Jews only who wanted to live Torah. When we came to Russia, it was an overwhelming experience. Saturday night, what you read about, I was there, I saw it, I took pictures of it. They used to meet in the cold of Moscow, in the cold of the winter. Hundreds and hundreds of refusnikim would meet in a central subway station in Moscow, a metro station, in the station, outside the station. You were freezing. And KGB agents in uniform, not in uniform, would be circulating Barabin, Bapumbi, writing down, taking notes, watching, listening. You don't know what communism was. And you, any home you were in, If they suspected you were engaged in these type of activities, there were spies, there were plans. The next door neighbor let the KGB put in a whole listening system. They picked up every word. Then they broke in when they wanted to. They arrested prisoners. You take Yuli Edelstein. They accused them of using drugs. You know what the drugs were? Spices for Havdalah. Those were the drugs that they accused Yuli Edelstein of using. So you have to understand what the period was. Now, he meets the sixth Rebbe for the first time, 1923. He had heard about the Rebbe, and this Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, was the son of Reb Shalom Dovber, the fifth Rebbe. The fifth Rebbe was a gaon adir. I don't believe that the sixth Rebbe was on the same level as far as Gaonis of his father. But what this man did, his father organized the first yeshiva, a Hasidic yeshiva. And you have to understand that this was an innovation. In the Lithuanian world, there were yeshivat. In the Hasidic world, everything centered around the Rebbe's court, and the Jungelites sat and learned, but there was no concept of an organized yeshiva. Lubavitch came along, and over 100 years ago, the first Tomchei Tumimim in Lubavitch organized a real yeshiva with classes, with exams, with students, with rebbeim, with a format. And his fifth Rebbe put the sixth Rebbe in charge of the yeshiva. The sixth Rebbe became a world traveler. When he got out of Russia finally, and with miracles after a death sentence and international intervention, and he comes to Riga. From Riga, ultimately winds up in Warsaw. Warsaw, he winds up, of course, in Brooklyn, and he travels, and he knows what's going on, and he raises funds, and he pours effort and energy to keep the underground going in Russia. And you can't believe, with all the communist pressure, think, how would you act? Here I am in communist Russia. This is 1985 now, and I come unannounced. You couldn't use the phone. I told you, 85 was a very difficult period. It was the storm before the lull, just the opposite. They were 85, 86, arresting people off the streets, endless prisoners of Zion. 87, the whole world started to change, and Chernobyl, and the whole communist system went under very quickly and very rapidly with very little bloodshed. It's an amazing thing when you look back. Amazing, amazing. And you come in, I knock on the door, Yitzhak Kogan's apartment in Leningrad, and there's Yitzhak Kogan with a few teenagers, with two Chabad shluchim from South America, umifabrent. In the middle of Leningrad, the middle with all the pressure, the fear, here's Yitzhak Kogan going in a car, goes 40, 50 kilometers out of Moscow, buys a cow, has a few Jews with him, they hold the cow down, Goyim help hold the cow down, they shech the cow, he cuts the cow up to pieces, what he can use he takes, the part that he gives to the Goyim he sells to the Goyim, brings it back, kashes it, distributes kosher meat to those who want it, to understand the essence of it. It's just an amazing story. And this was the sixth Rebbe. With it all, he was a master of Hasidut and Kabbalah and his Sichot, and he now meets this young man, Menachem Mendel. And an unbelievable relationship begins between them. And here I want to introduce a new volume that I'm now quoting for the first time. All of you know the name Harav Aten Steinsaltz. I've told you more than once that if there are three giants in this generation, he is one of them. Again, I have the privilege, I know him, our daughters studied together. His son was rented an apartment in my building for a number of years. So Baruch Hashem, I have the privilege, I've met him, I don't know, I told you the story with the blue shirt, did I ever tell the story here, did I tell it outside? A student, Lo Aleinu, what we go through in Israel, God should have mercy upon us and make it only good. So the 19 bus blew up around the corner from my house. It was one, I think it was the last bus to blow to be blown up. And I knew so many people on that bus that were killed. But on the bus was a lady from Russia who had come with her husband and two children, and he became a Messianic Chabotnik in Israel, and she couldn't handle it. They got divorced. He remarried, has a whole new family, maybe 5, 6, 7 children. And this lady was killed, leaving a young boy and girl without parents. The second wife wanted no part of the children from the first marriage, which you can understand. The mother is gone. So an aunt and uncle took them in, and my daughter, who had gained, unfortunately, fame in an unfortunate fashion because she brought back the Chazreslavist children, the family that was blown up from Holland and Sabaro, where we lost someone who walked out of this building who was here with a postgraduate program during the summer, a lady who was pregnant after years of not being pregnant, her first child on the way, she was killed. It was an Erev Shabbos, if you recall, the pizza place, doesn't exist anymore. Angels is there, I believe. So the Israeli government, meaning the social part that takes care of the orphans, lo aleinu, the two children who survived from this large family, they sent them to Holland. They had a wealthy aunt and uncle there, and the aunt and uncle here were poor people living in Hanov. Well, these kids were very unhappy, and my daughter got wind of it, and, you know, she's a tohenet and a lawyer, and she went pro bono, went to court, and got the kids brought back here, got the government to give the family in Hanov money to build on two rooms to their house, and they raised these children. So my daughter became well known, and when this happened, the court appointed her the guardian of this boy and girl. And this boy, Shimon, grows up part of my extended family. Whenever I'm my daughter, I meet him, and he meets a girl in Bnei Akiva, and this girl, unbelievable family, her father's from Germany, doesn't know how to hold the sitter right side up, came in the late 30s, big in Mapai, became an ambassador to Brazil, to Argentina, South America, didn't get married. Finally, in his good middle age, he met a Sephardic lady, a beauty of beauties, related to every bubber under the sun, and he married her. It was unbelievable to meet her, to meet him, and their daughter goes to Bnei Akiva, from girl. So at the wedding, all that represents Israel is there. So I'm wearing a blue shirt. My wife says, "You're going to a wedding, cut it out." If my wife knew how I think, she should have, "Don't dress like the Chafetz Chaim, dress the way a Rebbe should dress. Put on a white shirt, you're going to have," I think I had the first two brachot or the ktuva, but Rabbi Steinfeld says being Masada Kedushin. So I come to the wedding, and it was worth everything to me. My sons are looking at my grandchildren, Ben Kabanim, are looking at Rabbi Steinfeld like I would look at the Rav, like I would look at Rabbi Moshe with awe. And there's Rav Avraham Steinfeld, the Masada Kedushin, sitting there with a Bekesher with a beautiful blue shirt. And that was Rav Avraham Steinfeld. So I have to tell you, this past summer, 3 volumes came out on the Rav, on the Rebbe. The 7th Rebbe, Rabbi Steinfeld's volume, who writes fabulous English. It's hard to believe that this man's native language is French, Hebrew, Yiddish, and his English is better than ours. And of course, 2 volumes came out in America, one by Rabbi Chaim Miller, which is a scholarly biography of also a fabulous individual. This Chaim Miller didn't know an aleph from a bet until he graduates, what was it, Cambridge, Oxford, whatever, and Chabad picks him up, and within 10 years, he's the greatest, most learned Chabad person in the world, a giant, an absolute giant. And then you have Telushkin's volume. Now, these 3 volumes, you have to read all of them, because each one is different. Miller is the scholarly volume that approximates, except it's much larger, my monograph on the Rav in the first volume of the Rav. If you read my monograph, study my monograph, you wouldn't know I'm a Talmud. You read Miller's book, you wouldn't know he's a chassid. It's scholarly, it's fabulous. Telushkin's volume is more of a personal overlook at the Rebbe, from his understanding of the Rebbe. And he comes from a family where his father was the Rebbe's accountant, his grandfather was Echad Megedolei Yisrael, Gedolei Chasidei HaRebbe, Reb Nissen Tlushkin. And it's Chabadikim. I've heard Chabadikim criticize Rabbi Miller's volume. It's too scholarly. It doesn't have enough miracles in it. I've heard them criticize Tlushkin's volume. It's too westernized, you know. So I tell them, each one sees the Rebbe through their own prism. That's the greatness of the Rebbe, the greatness of the Rav. That's the greatness of what I told you yesterday, all our aggravation from this election, what went on in Shari Chesed, how many thousands, tens of thousands of votes are lost. I said, the minute someone tells you there's only one way to go and everyone else is wrong, keep away. If someone tells you, I have a point of view, but there are other points of view, you choose what's best for you. That's a healthy Torah attitude. And I have a lot more to say, but it's not for now. Rabbi Steinsaltz's volume is a chassid writing about the Rebbe. And there already I've heard the Litvakin criticize him. He says, all right, Tlushkin's volume I can swallow, Miller's volume I can swallow, but Steinsaltz, the Rebbe has Ruach HaKodesh. He says it in the volume. It's unbelievable. That's a chassid talking. But I have to tell you, Rabbi Steinsaltz, those of you familiar with his writings, it's a very unique individual. He changed the whole Torah gestalt of the world. If we have a Schottenstein today, it's because there's a Steinsaltz, and don't forget it. And he was the first, and I can't say what's coming out now, the new English version of Steinsaltz is fabulous. For someone who has a little learning, if you don't have any learning whatsoever, you need Schottenstein to give you a baby bottle. But the new edition of Steinsaltz in English, fabulous. And his insight to life, the man has insight, and he's admirable. When the Litvakin started attacking his Steinsaltz volumes, remember what went on before Schottenstein, he said, they're right, they're absolutely right, didn't fight, didn't answer, didn't argue, and just went on and did what he had to do. So I'm now quoting My Rebbe, by Adn Ibn Israel. By the way, he Hebraized his name, but it never caught on. You see, there's some people, you Hebraize your name, no one knows my name is Rothkopf. I told you, a fellow from the Kollel was told to go to this Dr. Rothkopf in Petach Tikva. He said, what the problem you have, he's the expert. He's as good as anyone in Florida. This kid came from Florida. So he goes to Rothkopf in Petach Tikva, and my brother says to him, what do you do? He says, I'm in Driscoll. He says, oh, do you study with my brother? And this dummy says, there's no Rothkopf on the faculty of Dris. So you see, Sharansky hebraized his name to Sharon, but it didn't catch on. No one knows it. Steinsaltz became Ibn Yisrael. Steinsaltz. It's a partial play. Stein. It's salt stone, salty stone. So it's a partial play in his name. Ibn is a stone, Yisrael. But no one knows it. But here it says Adn Ibn Israel, but what's in large letters? Steinsaltz. And I have to say, he captures the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe and the seventh Rebbe and their interaction. Beginning on page 56, and here he writes, when the Rebbe comes to America, again, the Rebbe had no dream in a million, zillion, trillion years that he would become the seventh Rebbe. But he comes, he works in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I've said more than once, they should put up a plaque in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, the man who went to become the greatest spiritual leader, bar none. He was the greatest spiritual leader than any other rabbi, but Lahavdil, the Pope, and everyone else in the world, worked here, give the years, whatever it was, 42 to 45, 41 to 44, whatever the years were. Okay, but he hangs out around the court, around 770. And as you saw when I read to you that memoir from Itcha David Grona, the students were attracted. Now, let's understand something. This is a literature world. What does a literature world mean? Who makes the faculty? The students. They're attracted. I can give you the history of Gross. Avram, we've had many teachers here. Some succeeded, some didn't. If students say, this Rebbe doesn't speak to me, he's not going to be a Rebbe that much longer. So, you see, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in that context at first, it was like a Litvish world. It's not, he's the Rebbe, his name is Schneerson. He was the Lubavitcher Rebbe's younger son-in-law. His image was certainly dwarfed by Reb Shmaya Guraye, who was already internationally known. But they speak with him, they talk with him. The man is unbelievable, his knowledge, his insight. During his first years in the States, the Rebbe, this is the seventh, forged strong connections with Chabad students, the young men in the yeshiva. Unlike Rabbi Guraye, who was the official head of the schools, the Rebbe's relationship was personal. I would also add the word voluntary. Personal and voluntary. You came to him if you wished. Some of them had already known him in Poland when he held Fabregins at the sixth Rebbe's request. Now, that's true. In Poland, occasionally the sixth Rebbe used him, utilized him. He knew what a gem he was. He spoke in public. He was intellectually impressive, as well as accessible. The students began to understand his loyalty to Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak, which won him their affection and devotion. Now, this is very, very important. The seventh Rebbe was totally loyal, we'll see in a minute, to the sixth Rebbe. To use Litvish language, he worshipped the ground that the sixth Rebbe walked on. He always referred to the sixth Rebbe as the Nasi Hadar. He constantly viewed himself as a weak Mamale Makam for the sixth Rebbe. And the students, who of course were all Talmidim of the sixth Rebbe, and particularly those who yet were a holdover from Europe. And you got to remember, they're very similar to Lakewood. When I learned in Lakewood, the heart of the nucleus around Reb Aaron Cutler were the survivors from Kletz. Their loyalty to Reb Aaron went way beyond Lakewood. This went back to Kletz, went back to Europe, went back to the Holocaust. Reb Aaron, the sixth Rebbe, these students knew from Lubavitch, these students knew from Tomke to Mimim, these students knew from Warsaw. These old timers yet linked back to what was. And here they saw this young man who had tremendous devotion for their Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe. Now, in the 1940s, Rabbi Steinfeld writes, the Hasidim began to notice how the future Rebbe spoke of the Riatz, how passionately he worked on his father-in-law's behalf. Whatever the sixth Rebbe asked him to do, he did with devotion, with love. While he did not often mix with others, the Rebbe would attend bar mitzvah and wedding celebrations and speak briefly. And yes, this Rebbe, he we'll see this very similar to the Rav. He was not a people's person. He could not mingle freely. He was different. The lonely man of faith. The movie about the Rav, I told you more than once that I argued with Abe Lavovitz, and I stand in awe of Abe, Jay, gave me $1 million for that movie. We never had a schnur, a penny, you understand what I'm saying? We never had to disgrace the Rav's memory. And it all goes back to my wife's grandparents davening in his father's shul in East New York. That's the way the connection begins between us. And I argued with Abe. And Abe, I said, you paint the Rav so lonely. I don't remember the Rav being so lonely. But he said, no, this is my take on the Rav. And I had a bow to him. I mean, he knew the Rav better than I did. I knew the Rav. I sat over here. The Rav sat here, right, for 4 good years. I knew the Rav. I knew him afterwards. I remained in touch with him, but I can't say I knew him intimately. Abe drove him around. Abe was his chauffeur. Abe was his, carried his golf clubs, as if to say, was his caddy, right? Is that the word they use? And Abe, everything, Abe knew him. But everyone tells me that it was an existential loneliness. It was not a social loneliness. The Rebbe was exactly the same way. But at this stage in life, he participated in bar mitzvahs, he participated in siddur kedushin, in marriages. You have books that have come out now on the Rebbe at weddings. I saw a beautiful coffee table volume with pictures of the Rebbe. All the pictures are before 1960. All the pictures are before 1955. It's when the Rebbe still had time on his hands. So, obviously, as lonely as he was, but the Rebbe intermingled. People spoke to him. People asked him shilas. People asked him for advice. And his father-in-law's direction. And remember, the sixth Rebbe could no longer speak in public at this point. He had had a stroke. Once a month, there would be a Fabrengen, and inevitably, the main speaker or one of the speakers would be the future Rebbe. So people got to know him. Now, in truth, Rabbi Steinsaltz says, the Rebbe's, again, I have to be careful here, the seventh Rebbe's devotion to the Riatz had been seen much earlier. In 1928, Rabbi Eliyahu Chaim Altholz, an older chassid, told the Riatz, quote, "Congratulations, you have a new chassid, your own Mendel," referring to Rabbi Menachem Mendel, who had now become his son-in-law. And this was a devotion, and it's an amazing thought, an amazing concept, because if you'll ask, again, a Litvish question, who is the bigger Lamden? What do we ask in the land of Lithuania? Who is the bigger Lamden? The seventh Rebbe was a gone Shebagainim, a gone Adir. The Rav was overwhelmed by his memory, his knowledge. Wow. Kala Torah Kula. A little kid named Donnie Rothkopf sat at a Fabrengen. He was blown away. There was Rabbi Yavis from Philadelphia. I'm telling you what I saw with my own eyes, with my own ears. I heard it. Rabbi Yavis, Rabbi Frank Yavis was Rabbi Feldblum's father-in-law. It was an ungarisha, photographic memory, knew Kala Torah Kula by heart. That he accomplished nothing in Philadelphia is a different story. That was Philadelphia then. It was all conservative. But he was a Rav in Philadelphia. He went to every Fabrengen, and when the Rebbe would start quoting Tosfos Baal Peh, Rabbi Yalis would be quoting a line ahead of him aloud, so everyone around him would know that he also knows the Tosfos by heart. But I wasn't, I knew what Rabbi Yalis knows, I knew him from Philadelphia, but the Rebbe, never the Rebbe commented. How can a man speak for endless hours not holding one paper in front of him, not holding one text in front of him? The Rebbe gave shir, I told you. We spoke about it yesterday with the Pine Heller, with the Sefer HaMitzvah. The Rebbe had a kid running up to the library, the Gottesman Library. Remember the second floor? Today I think it's the high school library. He'd send, bring my mitzvah hiner, bring my Rambam, bring me does, up the stairs, down, out, out, out. The Rebbe gave a public lecture, held a paper in front of him. He read every word. It's hard to realize how dramatic the Rav was able to be while reading the entire script. And here the Lubavitcher Rebbe called a Torah Kula. And yet Rabbi Menachem Mendel sensed in the Rebbe, he was the manhik hadah, the nasi hadah, the yeshiva, what he did in Russia, how he kept Yiddishkeit alive. How he was concerned with every Jew. And here you have Adam Steinsaltz, here you have the high point, this is the chassid speaking, page 57. However, becoming a Rebbe's chassid, if I may coin a term, is a far deeper and much more significant personal decision. In some ways, is like falling in love. Appreciation becomes admiration, liking becomes love, and the beloved is now deeply enshrined in the lover. Now, those of you who are happily married more than 50 years should be able to appreciate what I just read. It's magnificent. Magnificent. I repeat, falling in love, appreciation becomes admiration, liking becomes love, and the beloved is now deeply enshrined in the lover. Okay, if you saw Reb Moshe and his wife, if you saw the Rav and his wife, if you saw the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his wife, and we'll talk about it more obviously, you saw this before your eyes. This is why it's so hard for my generation to accept the flippancy and the lightheartedness and divorce and get in Hatchasnam and get Sikhap. It's like my attitude, what he called it, the maskan, air conditioner, broke down. So I called the service. They came, they fixed it, put in a new part, charged me 500 shekel, called them once, used it another time, called them a second time. They're coming now this Thursday, the third time, all on the first 500 shot. I'm not complaining about that. But I say, Ani, you're an idiot. The thing breaks down today, you throw it out. Who bothers getting it repaired? You understand? That's right. I look, I was an idiot. What am I wasting money and time and appointments and phone calls? All right, I barely used it. I had that one 10 years. I think I used it 5 times over there because I live very high up. It's cool in the summer. But marriage, divorce, shouldn't be like an air conditioner. But this description, this is a chassid. This is a chassid. He's in love with his Rebbe. Menachem Mendel saw his father as a great leader. Someone who could create new forms and ideas. In fact, he perceived Reb Yosef Yitzchak as a real messianic figure. Now that's a dangerous statement, but if you've heard my Shayurim, and I can't go into it now, in every generation there is no question about it, there is someone who is ra'i to be Mashiach. The generation has to be capable or be on a level that they deserve Mashiach Tzidkenu. And you see that? It's an open Gemara. Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lasot Et Chizkiyahu HaMelech Mashiach Amrad Midat HaDin Lefanav, that he didn't say Shira, but he had that capability. The genes were there. Halavai, halavai. In every generation, you see the Rambam. I heard this from the Rav. In the two places, the Rambam discusses Bar Kochba. He calls him HaMelech. What does it mean? That there was that ability in him, but the generation, Lo Zacha, wasn't meritous, wasn't worthy. So he says he saw the Riyadz, that he had that messianic drive. He could save the whole generation. The Rebbe would also often refer to his father-in-law as the leader of the generation, the Nasi, and he saw himself as a fulfiller of the dreams and visions of the older man. And you see, the Rebbe's entire kingship is Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe. Time and again he referred to himself as the shliach of the previous Rebbe. It's all the previous Rebbe. I'm just a child compared to him. I'm just a messenger bringing his message. And here's a paragraph you'll never forget. And and he gives you the source where he's getting it from in here. It is no exaggeration to say that whatever Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak said was holy to the Rebbe. To an outsider, the devotion is remarkable, even strange. Someone with the Rebbe's sheer intelligence would ordinarily also be intensely critical and questioning. Yet with utter sincerity, the Rebbe wholeheartedly accepted every aspect of the sixth Rebbe's thoughts and actions. is. That's powerful. Because having spent a lot of time among Gedolei Yisrael, boy, does Rabbi Steinsaltz hit it on the head. The more intelligence you have, the more critical you are. It's part of the personality. You have to work very hard. If you have intelligence, you have to learn a lot of Musa to remove that negative attitude, that negative outlook, to take off the negative glasses, to be able to give everyone credit and be encouraging and be positive. And here you have a seventh Rebbe who's a Gaon Adir, whose knowledge is fabulous. And yet he stands in awe of the sixth Rebbe. And here's the quote that's unbelievable. In one of his later talks, the Rebbe said, meaning the seventh Rebbe, that riding a horse is an accomplishment. Riding a horse? What's going on here? An accomplished human being must know how to ride a horse. The same is not true, the seventh Rebbe said, of driving a car. You can be an accomplished human being and not know how to drive a car. Now, wait a minute. To drive a horse, that I should do, to be an Adam Mushlam, and driving a car is not important? Ah. And then he explained himself. Because my father-in-law, the sixth Rebbe, the Riatz, could ride a horse, but did not know how to drive a car. Okay? Now, I don't know if Rav Admin Steinsaltz is saying this tongue-in-cheek, but this is very powerful. Yomo, do you know how to drive a car? You have a license? One second, if you don't have a license, do me a favor, don't drive a car. What are you? Okay. Don't. How did you learn how to drive if you don't have a license? But did you have the right for him to teach you? You got learner's permit? Then why didn't you finish and get a driver's license already? Either you wasted your time, if you had a learner's permit and you wasted all that time not learning and not hearing Rakefet Shurim via the website from 20 years ago when you went from the Kailel. But if you got the license, Mela. But you understand, this Mela thing, this is unbelievable the way he captures the relationship. Imagine to drive a car, not important, because the sixth Rebbe couldn't drive. But to ride a horse, mein Schwer, my father-in-law knew how to ride a horse. The future Rebbe's wife said of her husband, this is Chaim Mushkin, that he was her father's, quote, number one chassid, end quote. That's powerful. Let me just end off the chapter and I want to say a word about Pesach. For Menachem Mendel, all of Chabad was embodied in a Rebbe, in the Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak. The future Rebbe thought, and this too is very powerful, one cannot be half a chassid. Being a chassid is like being half a chassid is like being half pregnant. You either are pregnant or not. Either a chassid of the Rebbe or not. The Rebbe did the work he was told to do because his role was clear as a chassid. He was under that obligation. A leader can ask anything of someone who is devoted. And here Rabbi Steinsaltz sends off the chapter and I'll end off this part of the class. Yitzchak, do you know how to ride a horse? And you know how to drive a car? Baruch Hashem. Yitzchak is one step ahead of the sixth and seventh Rebbes. An old story describes the fiercely independent Druze people of Eastern Mediterranean, led by a leader known to outsiders as the Old Man of the Mountain. The Turkish rulers of the area would not abide the Druze and besiege their stronghold. A ceasefire was eventually called, and the opposing commanders met. The Old Man of the Mountain invited the Turkish general to join him in the citadel, where a festive meal was set on the top floor. While they were eating, the Druze sheik called to one of the soldiers and said, "You see that window there? Jump!" The soldier went through the window, jumped, and fell to his death. Then the sheik called another soldier and said again, "Jump from the window." He too jumped. The Turkish general left the dinner and asked the sultan for permission to make peace with the Druze, because we cannot fight with such a people that have such devotion to their leader. What are the limits of people who are beyond self-centered calculation? The Rebbe became, in that sense, Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak's number one chassid. So to reiterate, we're scratching the surface. We're trying to understand who this man was. And I'm a litvak looking in, as I said many weeks ago, so I can ask questions that no chassid can ask. But that question troubles me greatly. The seventh Rebbe, what a mind, what learning, what knowledge. But that's the difference. A litvak asked that question, a chassid, total dedication. And his wife, Chaya Mushka, who we will talk about in depth, and also Rabbi Steinsaltzer's insight on the relationship between the Rebbe and his wife is fabulous. His wife, Chaya Mushka, said to him, "My husband is my father's number one chassid." And that's the secret of their relationship. So the heart of what I said today, I filled in on Rabbi Valenkin, I filled in on the monument that last week we couldn't read clearly. Interesting, I learned that Reb Levi Yitzchak, the Rebbe's, seventh Rebbe's father, and Rabbi Valenkin, Reb Shmuel Zalman Valenkin, were very good friends from Cheder, and he was a Lamdan Mufak, Rabbi Valenkin. And that explains the secret of the relationship between them and how he comes to teach the Rebbe, how he comes to be a Malamed, and the relationship that goes on, Nitzchiyot. How the seventh Rebbe always felt in debt to Rabbi Valenkin. And then we spoke a few words about the engagement, but we left off because from that point on, once the seventh Rebbe meets the sixth Rebbe, they begin an intimate relationship. And we try to analyze it, and there I owe a great debt of thanks to Rav Adin Ibn Edwin Steinsaltz, his insights, his words, very quotable, and it just reveals not only the seventh Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, but reveals to you who Rav Adin Steinsaltz is. He's Chad B'Dorah. There's only one person like him in this generation. And we're leaving off when we pick up again, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up with the relationship of the Rebbe and his wife, and that amazing courtship that went on for 5 years, the amazing marriage was an event unto itself, as we shall see. And before I summarize everything in the freebies, let me just say a vort on Pesach. I want to say the vort in honor of Herbie Maltz, who's here. And Herbie Maltz often says to me, we're basically the same age, we know each other not as long as I know Yitz Rubin, we go back to high school together, Bnei Akiva, but Herbie Maltz, I think, comes in second place. We know each other from the day, basically, I came to the Essex County area. He was in Elizabeth, he remembers me yet a youngster, back in 62, trying to build Yiddishkeit where none existed, suburban Essex County. And his rabbi, Rabbi Teitz, was my mentor, etc. So I want to say, what we do Lel HaSeder is out of order. Anyone understands that the slavery in Egypt came before the emancipation? No, what's in memory of the slavery? The Marah. And what's in memory of the emancipation? The matzah. And yet you all know we come to the Suda, we finally reach it. And how does the Suda begin? Achilat matzah, the first mitzvah. And then only afterwards we make a bracha on achilat marah. It's exactly the opposite order that chronologically should take place. And this is a wonderful question. the Balei Musa, and some of you have studied Musa or heard my lectures from many years ago already, Musa had great psychological insight. And the Balei Musa gave a beautiful answer that in order to be a healthy human being, we have to have certain defense mechanisms. And one of the most important defense mechanisms is the ability to forget the bad and accentuate the good. If we don't have that defense mechanism, we falter. And you talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim, well, B'chol Davada, so much has gone by already. We came out. We became a free people. We received the Torah. We entered Israel. So much good has happened. That good outweighs the bad. It enables us to go further. It enables us not to dwell upon the evil. Only afterwards do Chazal, the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, tap us on the shoulder and say, now that you're saturated with goodness, with happiness, with achievement, with positivism, now recall what came before it. And that's why the matzah has to be before the mara. If not, we have psychological problems. We talk about the Holocaust, and not everyone who came out of it in one piece. There's still people today, particularly in the state of Israel, which has took in more Holocaust survivors than all the other countries combined, basically. You have people who are still in institutions who could never get over the nightmares, the trauma. I don't have to tell you, those of you that have fought in wars, not everyone comes back healthy. The trauma can live on and can compromise your life, your achievements. And I want to say, Herbie Maltz, it's really a pleasure to have him sitting here, because Herbie often says to me, I wasn't meant to be alive, what he went through. And take a look, so many years later, decades later, children, grandchildren, Al Admat HaKodesh, America, children, grandchildren, the most elite units in the army where my own grandchildren serve and served. And Baruch Hashem, Herbie, we can say, you eat a lot of matzah. That we have to eat mara, we have no choice. That's the destiny of a Jew, b'chol davada. But you eat a lot of matzah, and that's what's more important. The Rav said, it's a merit tikvot that I can never forget. In the middle of the Seder, when you come, b'chol davada, omim aleinu lekalotenu, you have to lift up the kos. What do you have to lift up a kos for? It's not a bracha, it's not a birchat mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah that needs a kosher bracha. It's not siddur kedushin, it's not havdalah, it's not kiddush. B'chol davada, to lift the kos. And the Rebbe said so beautifully, because in Tannitic language, in Tanakh, a cup of wine is the symbol of destiny. Kos yishu et asa uvishem Hashem ekra. Kos atareila. It's destiny. And the Jew's destiny that we can't escape. B'chol davada. When politicians here begin to speak, that moron from America, State Department, that it's about time Israel stopped being a nation unto itself. It's the biggest mistake ever. We can't escape our destiny. We are different. We can't escape our destiny. And that's why we lift the kos. So it's important. Yes, we have to eat mara. But a more healthy attitude is, of course, to eat the matzah first, b'lev v'nefesh. My daughter sent me a link circulating on YouTube. I stand in awe of what the computer has done. Lahagdil Torah, lahadira. You heard what I read yesterday from the comment on the YU, on my Shehurim, the YU Torah website, I was rebuked for criticizing the YU Torah. I explained myself yesterday what I meant, but the comment was overwhelming what the YU Torah website has accomplished. And on YouTube now, I turned it on this morning, I put it on my favorites. I should be able to turn it on whenever the news is disturbing. On the light rail in Jerusalem, and they've done this all over the world now in shopping malls, and they learn from them, and you're in this car, and they're panning the audience, chassid here, a chassid there, kippah shrugah, a black kippah, no kippah, Yerushalayim, the Jews in this car, and suddenly a woman with an operatic voice begins to sing Kol Ol Balevav. And a choir on the car joins in. It was planned. It was wasn't spontaneous. It was if it is spontaneous. They've done this in shopping malls where you have Broadway casts, and the whole car joins in Hatikva. And this is the matzah. This is wonderful. With all the heartache and all the sacrifice and all the price that we've paid. But Baruch Hashem, the matzah overwhelms us. For your edification, the next shiur is April 19th. April 19th, Sunday, and April 20th, Monday. The next week, this Thursday is the last day of the Kollel, so you have Sunday, Monday off, then Sunday, Monday of the Chag, then Sunday, Monday after the Chag, giving everyone a chance to get back, and the Kollel picks up again that Tuesday, so it's April, it's Rosh Chodesh Iyar that we meet again. If anyone wants, this is a Sicha by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. It essentially says exactly what I said in class last week, that we can have many different opinions, but we have to remember the framework is the halacha. If anyone wants information from about Rabbi Miller and Rabbi Lessen, I thank Josh Schneider. Here you read about Rabbi Miller, Rabbi Lessen. Rabbi Lessen was a top fundraiser in the Massachusetts area. And here's about Rabbi Lessen's hometown where he was rav before World War II, with a beautiful picture of the Lessen family before the Holocaust. What's wrong with the picture is it doesn't identify who's who. In other words, you can identify Rabbi Lessen and his wife who was killed by Hitler, Hashem Yikom Dama, but you can't identify everyone else, unless I imagine the Lessen family must know if anyone wants it. Here we are. This is for Alex. Alex, this is about the Krinsky family and their interrelationship with Rabbi Soloveitchik. Very fascinating. This is Lo Aleinu about the deadly fire in Flatbush and other tragedies in New York as a result of fires on Shabbat, and as a result of Brit Mila with the Mitzitza B'Peh. This is Lo Aleinu, what's going on in YU with the no confidence vote, and this is following up last week's article, and it's a sad situation there. It's very sad, because when you have machlokes between students and the Board of Trustees, the president caught in the middle, it is a problem. And finally, New York Times article with a problem that's going to haunt us, editing the human, how do you pronounce it, genome? Is it
genome?
How do you pronounce it?
Gnome.
Gnome, you don't pronounce the G-E, that's what I thought, so it's gnome. And about editing
genome.
That's what I said, editing the genome and editing genes and what type of human being, this is a very delicate question. We'd want everyone to be like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. No, do we have a right to do that? We want everyone to be like the Rav. Those of you who are sportsmen, want everyone to be like Eliyahu Chana. Those of you who grew up in the Bronx, everyone should be like Joe DiMaggio. Remember, the only one who was very happy when Elio Ohana was on the ticket.
My father saw him in San Francisco play, by the way.
Oh, my gosh, in San Francisco.
Yeah. And his brother, too, I think.
Dom and Dom Vince, yeah. Vince.
And Joe were all played for the Seals.
Right. The Seals, of course, left the O'Doul. And he hit in 61 straight games in San Francisco, in the Major Leagues 56. Ah, gentlemen, we're eating a little matzah now. And I want to thank you all for coming and until we meet again in health and happiness. Das v'danyu v'chag sameach v'kasher, if you understand. Purim, you have to say chag kasher, I mean, it's a drug. But Pesach, we work too hard. Crumbs on the floor and not chametz. It's an open halacha. But we work very hard. What woman would allow crumbs on the floor? So it's chag sameach v'kasher. And here's your email return.
Okay?
Yes, Rav Hashem.
You know this picture, right?
Yeah, sure. That's the love. That's hell if I would have had this picture yesterday.
There's Rabbi Twersky.
There's Rabbi Twersky, the Chatan. That's Rabbi Blaise Silva. That's David Twersky's. That's Rabbi. Who's that? Rabbi Meisha.
No, I'm nervous. Is that Rabbi Moshe?
No, it's not Rabbi Meisha. It's not Rabbi Chaim Heller by any chance. It could be Rabbi Chaim Heller.
Yeah, somebody told me who it was, and now I forget. I have to mark it down.
There's the Rav. Wow. That's the Talmud Rebbe, right?
That's the Mechutin, yeah.
Yeah, the Mechutin. That's his brother from Philadelphia. Yeah.
Who is it?
That's Rabbi Leisa Suva.
Oh,
maybe I have a story for you, and then maybe you have something for me. It's a Rav Kogan story. When we first got to Moscow, we went to Topol Shaya, and we went into to the back where they have the butcher set up, and Kogan takes out this huge slab of meat and starts, it's frozen, and he has this like, old chain, and he cuts us, this saw. Right, and he starts, cutting us the size of the piece of meat that we want, whatever. Then, about a week later, we wanted, it was Thursday afternoon or something, and we sent our housekeeper to pick up some meat from Bolshaya. And she goes into the back, and he's not there. One of the Hasidim is there. And she says, I'd like to purchase some meat. He says, sorry, we don't have. She says, some chicken. Sorry, we were out. She's like, is there anything or do you have white dark meat? No, nothing. She comes back and my mom's really surprised. So she goes Friday before Shabbos to pick up some meat and to ask Rav Kogan why they didn't have anything. And he said, of course we have. We have plenty. What do you mean? Yeah, what do you mean? And she said, well, I said my housekeeper. And he said, oh, she's not Jewish. And she said, yeah, she's not Jewish. She said, oh, we don't sell them the nachos.
So I took a picture in 85 of Sophie of Passion and Chicken.
Yeah.
That picture went all over the world. It was published. I couldn't get credit. Triple SJ got credit. I was supposed to be in Russia. Take a look in Washington at the pictures there. I don't know whether they used it or not. Okay. I mean, it's quite an interesting picture. You don't see Sophia, but you see the chickens. And you see primitive kashering, but the amazing thing is that's in Leningrad.
Wow.
I'm speaking this Friday night here at the Kollel. I'm speaking about maybe Rabbi Kelly with some Makoros.
One second. Sure. Yeah, what are you speaking about?
Speaking about doubt.
About what?
Doubt and certainty.
Person probably to talk with is my son-in-law, Chaim Meisel, Rabbi Eisen. You know what I'm talking about? He teaches at the Yoyu Center. He's a great philosopher. He knows everything. But that was certain thing. From a halachic point of view, looking to the Rambam in Hilchat Tshuva, the whole, if there wouldn't be choice, there'd be no Schava Onish. And this is why, if religion would be black and white, that you could see God speaking to you, how's this Schava Onish? You understand? So all of doubt is healthy, but it enables us to make a proper decision.
At the same time, the Rambam demands certainty with Emunah. But beyond Emunah, or the idea, is there anything that we should be certain about?
Well, you're now raising the question of the Yud Gimel Ikarim. You follow? Are there Ikarim? Certain Matan Torah? You follow me. Certainly, without that, nothing gets off the floor. But the Yud Gimel Ikarim is an interesting question. They have to get involved with Mark Shapiro's book. You know what I'm referring to? The book, he shows that not everyone accepted the Yud Gimel Ikarim.
Right.
Some had more, some
third
had
one.
Less. But I would say, by the way, the Sefer Ikarim takes issue with the Rambam and shows. But certainly the basics, one has to believe, B'lev V'Nefesh. If you don't believe, how can you have a concept of Kiddush Hashem? Okay, the Rambam, Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah. Understand? But on the other hand, you have to deal with post-Holocaust, that it was healthy for people to have doubt. It deals with what I spoke about today, Matsumura.
Right, right.
And it deals with Jack Gold and the whole video on Borough Park, where what's my choice, to give them another victory? You follow? So besides, you have to put it together. But I wouldn't make people feel that if they have doubt that they're bad Jews. Understand? To doubt is normal, it's healthy. You have to learn, you have to see, you have to see life. This is the book of Job. Who were you? You weren't here when I created the world. If you don't see the ultimate picture. So you have to do it that way, if that's what you're speaking about. But that's the way I would handle it. But I'm not a great philosopher. My son was a philosopher. I hope I know halacha, and I hope I know Jewish history. But philosophy, I always felt with philosophy, there's no right and there's no wrong. You understand? So say that when you love halacha, it's more tangible.
So that's kind of my question, because is there certainty in halacha?
Now you're dealing with what I've lectured on since the Kollel began in 78. But no, there is certainty that there's a halachic system. And there's a big difference.
The system itself
right, it's certain. But there's a big difference between a din d'oraita and a din d'rabbanan.
Right.
How we handle it. But when a person gives a psak, is there certainty? No, because others can differ.
Right.
But ultimately, you hit crystallization. Hit kapshut, but you couldn't be better. You follow? Hit kapshut. It's Rambam. Haktomer is the Mishnah Torah. Anyway, those are good questions. They're not solved in a minute.
Okay.